This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney John Burroughs, a specialist on treaty regimes and international law relating to nuclear and other non-conventional weapons.
If you're worried about global climate change and the big wave hitting Manhattan, something else could hit Manhattan too.
We have Professor Joel Covell, author of the recent and extraordinary book, Overcoming Zionism, speaking to us about the efforts of the Zionist thought police to suppress his book.
This is a story that could only happen in America. What happened to free speech and free universities?
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Has been drawn after the 2001 attacks on the United States to the need to marginalize nuclear weapons and increase global cooperation on the control and nonproliferation of nuclear weapons and nuclear material. But rather than intensifying such efforts, the United States has adopted a policy of elevating the role of nuclear weapons in its overall military strategy. John Burroughs, executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, claims that this will reduce U.S. and global security, not increase it. John Burroughs is also adjunct professor of international law at Rutgers Law School in Newark. He is a specialist on treaty regimes and international law relating to nuclear and other non-conventional weapons. He has a J.D. and Ph.D. from the University of California at Berkeley and a B.A. from Harvard. John, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
John, tell us a bit about the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, why it was formed, what you do.
It was formed by lawyers and academics in the early 1980s in response to the fear that was caused by talk of the Reagan administration about fighting a nuclear war. So it's been going for about 25 years, and we've done a lot since then. In the 1990s, we spearheaded an NGO public campaign to support the effort to get an advisory opinion on nuclear weapons from the International Court of Justice. In this decade, we were involved in efforts to stop the Iraq invasion before it started. And, of course, we've continued to analyze U.S. reliance on nuclear weapons and the problem of proliferation of nuclear weapons. We've been very active in the context of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty as well as the United Nations. And we just put out a book with two other organizations, Nuclear Disorder or Cooperative Security.
I'm in the middle of reading this book. It's an excellent book, Nuclear Disorder or Cooperative Security, which says it all in the title. And I'd like you to tell our listeners, John, how they can get a hold of a copy of this book.
Right. Well, you can just go to a website that's devoted to the project. It's WMDReport.org. And, you know, I'm very happy with this book because it contains a lot of the work that we have done over the last few years, but also two organizations that we collaborated with, Reaching Critical Will of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and Western States Legal Foundation from Oakland, California. And it covers a range of topics. the problem of nuclear weapons, the non-proliferation treaty, but also dealing with the problem of nuclear weapons in the wider context of U.S. militarism and what can be done about it.
John, you say in the book that things were not so great under Clinton, but they've gotten much worse under the Bush administration. Can you explain why that's so?
Well, you know, after the end of the Cold War, there was some hope that the nuclear nightmare would be brought to an end. In 1995, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was, in effect, renegotiated. The NPT bars all countries from acquiring nuclear weapons except five identified nuclear weapon states, the United States, Britain, France, China, and Russia. But they are obligated under the treaty to negotiate nuclear disarmament. Well, the treaty was up for extension in 1995, and as part of the package of extension, the nuclear weapon states agreed to negotiate a comprehensive test ban treaty and to take steps towards reducing their arsenals towards the goal of elimination. So the Clinton administration supported this, but in 1994, a nuclear posture review had been adopted, which essentially said the United States is going to go on relying on possible massive use of nuclear weapons in the same way it had done during the Cold War. And the Clinton administration never really made changing the nuclear dynamics a priority. By 1999, the Senate rejected the comprehensive test ban treaty, which had been negotiated in 1996. And the efforts of the Clinton administration on that were really ineffectual. And the Clinton administration also started laying the groundwork for the expansion of options of use of nuclear weapons that was really emphasized by the Bush administration to say that nuclear weapons could be used in response to chemical or biological weapons or capabilities, in other words, preemptive strikes against those, as well as against nuclear threats and against overwhelming conventional threats. So a lot of what we've seen during the Bush administration years sort of had its beginnings during the Clinton administration years, but it's certainly true that things have gotten dramatically worse during the Bush administration. You'll remember that in 2002, the Bush administration withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The Bush administration reached a three-page agreement, which hardly deserves the name of treaty, with Russia on reduction of deployed strategic weapons in 2002. It did not contain any verification provisions, unlike all past U.S.-Soviet and U.S.-Russian arms control agreements. And as I hope listeners know, in various ways, for instance, in the nuclear posture review, the Bush administration expanded at the presidential level, expanded options for use of nuclear weapons. And, you know, Seymour Hersh was reporting a couple of years ago that at the very highest levels, which I interpret to mean at least Cheney, that the Bush administration wanted to keep options for use of nuclear weapons in plans for attack on Iran.
We're speaking with John Burroughs, who's a professor at Rutgers, also an attorney, modestly asked us to please call him John. And John is the legal representative for the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy to various international bodies. He's a major contributor to a book that's just come out, Nuclear Disorder or Cooperative Security, and we're going to tell you how to get a copy of that in a minute.
John, the United States has adopted a policy of actually elevating the role of nuclear weapons as part of its military strategy. I'm sure the government thinks this is going to make us safer, but I believe you have quite the opposite viewpoint.
Yeah. Well, people, I think, have forgotten what supernatural devices nuclear weapons are. A bomb the size of the Hiroshima bomb, which is about, 12 to 15 kilotons, would destroy lower Manhattan. And bombs that are now deployed by the United States are anywhere eight and more times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. So basically, The United States and the other nuclear weapon countries have bombs that can devastate cities.
How many bombs are out there amongst the various countries that have nuclear weapons, and how many does the United States have?
There's about 25,000 total in the world. The United States has about 10,000, Russia has maybe 14,000, and the rest are distributed among the other countries, Israel, India, Pakistan, China, France, Britain. So, yeah, that's a reduction from about 70,000 was the highest total during the Cold War. So these weapons they're off the human scale, Ted Taylor, the physicist, used to say. It's just silly to think that countries can have them, but there's never a chance that they're going to be used.
I wanted to talk to you about that, John, because as we know, the United States is the only country that ever used nuclear weapons. They used it twice, not just at Hiroshima, but also Nagasaki. What has been the history in the last, 62 years since the Americans dropped the bomb on Japan? What's been the history of threats to use it since then?
The United States, it was reported, was reserving the option of possible use of nuclear weapons against Iran. And that's a sort of threat. You know, if you're an international lawyer, might say, well, there's only a threat if there's a specific statement made and you have to do X or we are going to use nuclear weapons. But there's this sort of talk that goes on about use of nuclear weapons. There are presidential documents about the use of nuclear weapons, especially during the Bush administration. The United States has said, for example, that it would use nuclear weapons in response to a North Korean attack on South Korea. Not a North Korean nuclear attack, just a North Korean attack on South Korea. And it was a standard Cold War position of the United States that it would use nuclear weapons in response to a Soviet tank invasion of Europe.
And Nixon would have used them if he thought he could get away with it.
Right. There were reports that Nixon had plans to announce the possible use of nuclear weapons and that the large peace demonstrations deterred him from doing so. So it's been a part of sort of U.S. posture for sure for these past decades.
I'm thinking of the movie Failsafe and the novel On the Beach, all those. Mm. I don't understand how the authorization is given, especially with what we call a unitary executive. What systems are in place in our government should we feel that we're being attacked and want to launch a nuclear missile? How does that happen exactly?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't really know the answer to it. But it leads me to this point that, unbelievably, the United States and Russia, right now as we're sitting here and talking, have the ability to launch about 2,500 nuclear weapons at each other within half an hour of an order to do so, the detonations would take place. So we are still in the sort of Cold War nuclear standoff, and there's just denial and complacency about that. So far as I understand it, U.S. use of nuclear weapons is supposed to be authorized at the presidential level, but there's no provision for Congress agreeing to it, for example. And I'm sure that there are provisions for lower-level officers to use them if the president isn't available and so on.
A nuclear weapon just doesn't go off and blow something up and that's the end of it. What would be the consequences of the use of a nuclear weapon in today's world?
Well, you know, since the 1980s, there's been an understanding that if there was a massive exchange of nuclear forces, it would essentially end the societies involved, Russia and the United States, or China and the United States, and could even have ecological consequences for the world nuclear winter that could spell the end of human civilization. This is the sort of apocalyptic understanding of nuclear weapons, and maybe it's partly why people don't want to deal with it. But it's also important to understand that using even one or a few nuclear weapons would be a total catastrophe. City destroying. Can you imagine that?
Well, speaking of one, isn't it correct that a week or two ago, 6 nuclear weapons were missing and only 5 have been recovered?
I haven't seen anything about only 5 of them being recovered, but it has been widely reported that there were, I think it was 6, that were transported, and it was not expected or authorized that they be transported.
Over the United States.
That's right, between 2 bases in the United States. So this is going to turn into a big inquiry as to how that could happen. And obviously, sort of at a mundane level, the people respond like, well, don't we have better safety and security regarding our nuclear weapons? You know, what concerns me is, and this is total speculation, but what concerns me is, you know, possible connection to what seems to be a ramp up of U.S. rhetoric regarding Iran. I just have to ask the question, was this apparent mistake, was it sort of a signal to Iran, you know, we do have these nuclear weapons? As I say, that's total speculation, but it's really quite hard to understand how this could have happened just as a mistake.
John Burroughs of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. Let me bring this to a more optimistic conclusion. There is a nuclear nonproliferation pact that was signed in 1970. There are suggestions out there in the international community as well as laws that would give us some guidance on how to get out of the horrible situation that the world is in now because of nuclear weapons. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how we could retreat from this death wish position that we're all in?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the nonproliferation treaty was a bargain. Most countries gave up the ability to have nuclear weapons, and the countries that had them agreed to negotiate nuclear disarmament. In its 1996 opinion, the International Court of Justice, the judicial branch of the United Nations, said that obligation means the countries have to pursue and bring to a conclusion negotiations on the elimination of nuclear arsenals. And in the context of review meetings for the Nonproliferation Treaty, a great deal of substance has been given to that obligation. In 2000, when the Clinton administration was still in, the United States agreed, along with all other participating countries, to an agenda that would lead to a nuclear weapon-free world, bringing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty into force, negotiating a treaty banning the production of material, highly enriched uranium and plutonium for nuclear weapons, verified an irreversible reduction of nuclear arsenals, a diminishing role of nuclear weapons in security policies. As I say, it was comprehensive and sophisticated, but much of it has since been rejected by the Bush administration. Still, the template is there for how to achieve a nuclear weapons-free world. And very interestingly, this year, in January 2007 of this year, 4 realists, 4 former top U.S. officials, Kissinger, Shultz, Nunn, and Perry, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that we have to reaffirm the vision of a nuclear weapon-free world and take concrete steps towards its achievement. Well, why did they say this? I think they said it because it wasn't so much the moral and legal critique that has been so well articulated by people like Jonathan Schell and the International Court of Justice. For them, it was more a security perspective. They really think that the nuclear situation is becoming unmanageable. If you see the possible acquisition of nuclear weapons by additional countries, North Korea, all that perhaps is in the process of being reversed. Iran seems to be seeking at least a capability to make nuclear weapons. If you see the possibility of acquisition of nuclear weapons by terrorists, and you add that into the existing very complicated mix involving the nuclear policies of the major states, China, Russia, the United States, and so on, you add all that together, it begins to look very unmanageable. And they said, we have to change course and move towards a nuclear weapons free world. And that has been echoed, interestingly, in the presidential campaigns. John Edwards has said that the United States, if he's president, the United States will lead the world towards the elimination of nuclear weapons. Of course, Denis Kucinich says this.
Can you explain how the active, or is it called fissile material in warheads, if we dismantle warheads, how do we destroy of the material, and how, what are our capabilities of doing that so that they can't be reassembled and reused?
Well, it can be done. In the case of highly enriched uranium, it's possible to downblend it, they call it, and burn it in nuclear reactors. If that is deemed unacceptable because people don't want nuclear power, there are other ways of rendering it incapable of being used in nuclear weapons. The same goes for plutonium. For example, plutonium can be mixed with highly radioactive waste, and then it will have to be disposed of. And, you know, there's an effort to now dispose of it at Yucca Mountain in Nevada, which is running into lots of problems. So it's a serious technical problem, but it can be done, and to some extent it already is being done.
And can you explain a bit about what our government is doing in terms of who is working on investigating things like that?
Well, not as much as I would like. You know, the Bush administration has veered away from the idea of verifiably and irreversibly reducing our nuclear arsenals. But, you know, there are experts on these matters. The National Academy of Sciences has done a series of studies over the years. The Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which is chaired by Hans Blix, also has studied these matters. And in fact, it was the WMD Commission report that came out in 2006 that our book in part was responding to.
I'm curious, in the mid-80s, there was a very active anti-nuclear movement. I myself was arrested at a demonstration then. Why do you think we don't have that kind of movement by the people on this issue when it seems even more dangerous?
Well, after the Cold War, you know, people sort of had a sigh of relief and said that, and there tended to be this feeling that the problem was over. And Clinton certainly didn't help that by saying things like, we have detargeted our missiles rushing the United States, forgetting to add that they could be retargeted in a matter of seconds. And I think also at an elite level, you know, say the New York Times or national security universities, there was a sense that we are not going to pursue a nuclear weapons-free world. The United States is going to continue to rely on nuclear weapons. And that sort of seeped into reporting on it. But in this decade, in a certain way, the issue has come back to the fore, but it's all been about, well, Ahmadinejad might get the bomb or Osama might get the bomb. It's been counterproductive in some ways. It's been about fear. It's been all about the other guy might get the bomb. And really, we have to focus on the problem of the weapons themselves. What does it take for the world to get rid of these weapons?
John, you mentioned Iran earlier. Tell us a little bit more about what we face.
Yeah, I think it's urgent that people really focus attention on this problem right now. And I'll tell you why. On August 28th, President Bush spoke to some veterans of foreign wars. And he said that to protect U.S. troops against what the U.S. says are supply of advanced roadside bombs and other things to insurgents in Iraq, he said, I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities. The United States is also considering declaring the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization. It has a major strike force in the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, Iran is defying Security Council resolutions and continuing to develop and operate its uranium enrichment capability. And, you know, enriched uranium can be used to fuel nuclear reactors, which is what Iran says it wants it for. But if Iran kicked out the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, in some period thereafter, maybe a year, probably longer, they could make highly enriched uranium for weapons. So we've got an unfortunate confrontation and an intense confrontation going on between the United States and Iran. Bush continues to use fairly ominous rhetoric. In the same speech, he said, Iran's active pursuit of technology that could lead to nuclear weapons threatens to put a region already known for instability and violence under the shadow of a nuclear holocaust. That's why he said the United States is rallying friends to isolate the regime and to impose sanctions. Then he said, we will confront this danger before it is too late. So it is really important that the United States and Iran, either the two countries or maybe involving other countries, negotiate. Now, you may say, well, why aren't they negotiating already? Well, the United States has said we won't negotiate with Iran until Iran stops enriching uranium. So Iran has to do the very thing that would be the subject of negotiations before the negotiations can begin. And it would be comical, except it is so extremely serious. Diplomacy has been working regarding North Korea. It appears that North Korea is starting to unwind its nuclear program in response to negotiations that involve several countries in the region, but including the United States. And perhaps I'm going on too long here, but I want people to understand that there is potential to resolve the nuclear situation. The IAEA continues to monitor activities in Iran and just reported that it has found no materials diverted to nuclear weapons by Iran. In other words, Iran has been accounting for all its materials as it's supposed to do. There are various outstanding issues regarding Iran's past nuclear activities that it did not adequately report to the IAEA, which sort of set off in part this whole situation. But the IAEA and Iran have agreed on a plan to wrap that all up by the end of this year. And Iran has said it's willing to negotiate about operating limited enrichment facilities in Iran with heightened IAEA monitoring and possibly also with foreign participation, you know, like, say, the European consortium, Urenco, being involved. So the ingredients are there for a resolution. But the problem is the United States and Iran have this underlying hostility that goes back to the hostage crisis in 1979 and also back to the U.S.-backed coup in 1953 that overthrew Iran's prime minister, Mossadegh. So there's a lot to deal with there, but it's so important to deal with it because otherwise we're possibly heading towards U.S. attacks on Iran. We're possibly heading towards unraveling of the nonproliferation treaty, at least in the Middle East. So I encourage people to really pay attention and to urge our government to take a course of diplomacy, not war.
If it was needed in any particular instance, this certainly seems like the one where we have to be diplomatic. This has been an illuminating session, and we really hope to stay in touch with you and have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
I'd be glad to be back. Thanks.
Thank you, John.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We're welcoming Joel Covell back to our studios. The chair he sat on 3 weeks ago is barely cooled off, and he's back again. Joel, as the audience will remember, is the author of the just magnificent book called Overcoming Zionism, which proposes a one-state solution to the situation over there. We have Joel Covell back on the show because the book may be suppressed. It's being distributed by the University of Michigan Press. We're not sure just how long it's going to be out there, and we want to inform our audience about what's happening. Joel Covell, welcome back so soon.
Greetings.
To Law and Disorder.
Greetings. Well, it's a pleasure being here, although the reason is perhaps not so pleasant.
It's obviously quite a stir already, which is pretty remarkable. Your book has only been out a few weeks.
No, well, that's testimony to the strength of that book, that it really angered the wrong people. That is, it angered the Zionist thought police in America. Yeah. Joel, tell the audience what happened.
Yeah, well, the book has been out for a few months, but it's interesting that it hasn't been reviewed. It hasn't been, except by certain notable people.
I reviewed it.
But it hasn't been reviewed in any widely published print medium, okay?
But it's a bestseller nonetheless, right? Kind of underground?
Well, that's the strength of word of mouth and the internet and reviews such as yours, Mike, one or two others. But in any event, even the first printing sold out, and I heard from Pluto since this fracas erupted that now it's really moving in the charts. Pluto Press is the publisher.
Yes,
so it was published by Pluto, which is has been around for about 25 years. It publishes out of London. It's a small, distinctly left-wing publishing house. And
that's the publisher that publishes a lot of Chomsky's stuff, too,
publishes
right?
Chomsky. In fact, if you look at the Pluto webpage, you'll see website, you'll see a whole page for Chomsky and Pluto.
Yeah, Pluto Press, and they're distributed here in the United States by the University of Michigan Press.
Which was considered quite a feather in their cap to have a major academic publisher take on this
role. And vice versa. There's some distinguished titles that have come out under Pluto.
Sure.
So tell us what happened with that relationship between Pluto and University of Michigan Press, and how come Overcoming Zionism is being threatened with suppression.
Right. Well, it has already attracted some attention of that sort. About a month ago, a similar attack erupted but nothing really came of it. This one was announced about a little more than 2 weeks ago by a call from the director of the press, who shall go unnamed for now, and word was that a group that was a branch of Campus Watch Movement, which is the generic term for those right-wing groups that try to suppress free speech on campus by being sort of vigilantes and putting considerable political pressure on universities and publishers and the like, was now launching a major attack on my book, but also, and through my book, on Pluto Press. I think that what's particularly significant is that there are two aspects to this. It's not just this one book they're trying to dispose of, but it's the publishing firm that, aside from being a generically very good left publisher, it undoubtedly is the left publisher with the largest and the widest selection of books that are critical of the state of Israel, that are, supportive of the rights of Palestinians and the like. I mean, they have about 40 or 50 titles on this subject, including books on Hamas even. They have the definitive book on the Hamas movement and the like, which is treated sympathetically as, a real political force and not demonized. Pluto and Michigan had this pretty good relationship for about 4 years, and along comes my book. Now, whether my book is special, I don't know. I mean, in one sense, it's not. I mean, it's my book, and that's interesting to me, but it's one book in the Pluto series. On the other hand, I think there has been an increased tempo of these attacks coming about. I think the Zionist lobbies in general are feeling somewhat threatened and cornered by U.S. Foreign policy setbacks in the Middle East and the linking of this with the Zionist lobbies, the Israel lobbies, as Walt and Mearsheimer have said in their recent book on the Israel lobby. Jimmy Carter has weighed in, and there's a general questioning of the domination that the Zionist thought police, as we're now coming to call it, exerts, and that may be responsible for it. In any event, This group, which is called Stand With Us Michigan, namely it's the Michigan chapter of the Stand With Us group, which is headquartered in Los Angeles, has a chapter at the University of Michigan, a chapter at Columbia here in New York, and a chapter in Tel Aviv, was now launching a very real, you know, real roundhouse punch against my book and then through my book at Pluto Press.
We're speaking with Professor Joel Covell, recent author of Overcoming Zionism, a book that proposes a one-state solution to the situation over there. Joel Covell is a prominent political figure on the left. He ran for Senate years ago in New York State. He was a candidate for the possible nomination of the Green Party. He's written 10 books. His latest, Overcoming Zionism, is under fire from what we call the Zionist thought police. They're attempting to suppress it.
Right.
And can you tell us a little bit about what this Campus Watch group said about your book?
Yes. Well, the newsletter, which was released in the middle of August, stated that radical anti-Israel author distributed by University of Michigan Press. There are a bunch of other articles in this newsletter, including one that Israel is well-suited for partnerships with Michigan. This is like an appeal to the governor of Michigan to make a deal with the state of Israel.
But what did they say specifically about your book?
Anti-Israel author Joel Covell's 2007 publication, Overcoming Zionism, is distributed in the United States exclusively by the University of Michigan Press. The book is a polemic against Israel, condemning Jewish support for the state and blaming Israel for nearly every wrong, real or perceived, in the entire Middle East. Covell's Israel is the very definition of imperialistic and malicious in its systematic oppression of a morally neutral Palestine. The book itself is dedicated to Rachel Corey, which I thought it was kind of
nice. To your everlasting credit, Joel.
Remind our listeners who Rachel Corey is.
Rachel Corey is, I said Rachel Corey, I didn't like the rhyme, but I said, Rachel Corey, may she live in glory. A heartbreaking event that occurred in March of 2003 when Rachel, who was a student from Evergreen State University in Western Washington, working with the International Solidarity Movement, was in Rafah, which is the southernmost town in Gaza, and was trying to stop Israeli house demolitions, of which have occurred at the rate of some 19,000 since the 1967 war throughout the territories. And in the course of it, she was brutally murdered by a bulldozer. Instead of demolishing the house, demolished Rachel Corey in full view of everybody. It was a cloudless day. There was perfect visibility. She was wearing an orange flak jacket. The bulldozer, which is supplied, it should be noted, by the United States government, manufactured by the Caterpillar Corporation here. It's called a D9 bulldozer. It's like a 60-ton bulldozer. It's about as big as your house, and it's there to tear up houses. And in this case, it picked up Rachel, who was, you know, to the horror of everybody, tossed her down, ran her over, backed up, crushing her to death, and then went on its way. And as horrible as this was, the horror was more or less, I should think, even worsened by the attitude of the United States government to this event. You have to remember, this was around the time when, this was when America was invading Iraq. Jessica Lynch. Yeah, was allegedly, raped and abducted by Iraqis, and which, of course, was a total disinformation. But that roused the country. It was a fever pitch, and all of the senators beating the drums. This is a made-up story. At the same time, an American citizen was brutally murdered in the territories by a U.S. bulldozer and an Israeli army driver. And it completely shut up. I mean, you know, it just disappeared from sight, except that the story is so heartbreaking and poignant that it has become a focus of a lot of,
And you dedicated education. You dedicated the book in part to Rachel Corey.
Right.
And that's one of the things outfit, the censors, go after you on for having the nerve to dedicate it to this brave young woman.
Yeah. I see next, Joel, here is that after Stand With Us writes this critique, if you want to call it.
You want to call it just this.
How about a hatchet job?
Right, whatever you want to call it. Something much worse than a critique. Then you get this letter from the director at the University of Michigan Press.
Right.
And he says, look, after I saw the stand-up.
Yeah, why don't you read it, Michael?
Read some of it.
I will, but he says, after I saw the Stand With Us diatribe, he calls it a diatribe, what Stand With Us did to your book, he said, he was ready to defend the book. And what he says, I and others read it after that assault by Stand With Us.
and, quote, had fully expected to gear up for at least a free speech defense.
At least.
So he was willing at that point. Yeah. He said, look, there's a free speech issue here, and I'm going to defend it. We distribute this book through Pluto, and I'm going to defend it. Then he goes on to say, and this is, I just was flabbergasted by this letter. It's like a total contradiction.
You couldn't make this up.
No, you couldn't make it up. And it goes on, it quotes, it says, though I had no trouble with the one state solution, again, this is the director of the University of Michigan Press, saying, though I had no trouble with the one state solution your book proposes, nor with a Zionist critique per se, we had, after all, proudly and successfully published Virginia Tilley, I and faculty members I asked to read the book as well were, quote, appalled by your reckless, vicious, and unmodulated attack on Zionism and all Zionists. For us, the issue raised by the book is not free speech, but hate speech. As a result of that letter, they then decide they are not going to distribute the book.
The book was summarily dropped, yes.
Now that's, I mean, you know, I want to hear your reaction to that, but, you know, just reading that, it's remarkable. The guy is a publisher of a press. He agrees that there's a free speech element at the press. He reads your book.
Right.
He disagrees with your book. All of a sudden, it no longer is a free speech issue.
Yeah.
It's a hate speech issue, and they're not going to publish it. Yeah. So what happened to free speech?
Perhaps you legal scholars could tell me the status of hate speech in these debates. I think it has no status, if I'm not mistaken. In any event, the point about free speech, as I'm sure we all recognize, is that it's the protection not just of what you like, but of what you're disagreeing with. And even dislike intensely.
Isn't that the point of publishing books?
Yeah, I thought that
was the point. Isn't that the point of writing?
Isn't that the point of intellectual activity? I should say this is heightened by the fact that this publisher and I go way back. He once edited a book of mine that I wrote many years ago when he worked for another publisher as an editor. But I was taken aback. I have to say I was shocked. You know, it was like, what? You know, how? What's going on here? At the same time, I recognize that whatever's going on here, to use the vernacular, he lost it. Something happened that
he lost it, or someone said, you published this book, and we are in deep trouble at University of Michigan.
And you're in deep trouble.
And you're in deep trouble.
And you're in deep trouble as the publisher.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And therefore, he just reacted. I mean, that's like...
But lost it, because, you know, the sequel is very interesting.
Yeah, so what happened next?
What happened?
You get this letter about when?
The 22nd of August.
So just a couple of weeks ago, right?
We're speaking here with Professor Joel Covell, who's written an outstanding book called Overcoming Zionism. The book, maybe not suppressed, and we're talking about what happened when the University of Michigan, the book's distributor, came under fire by the Zionist thought police.
Yeah.
What happened next, Joel?
Well, the first thing, of course, is I started communicating with certain friends about this, because there are a lot of folks now who have sort of, quote, had it up to here with the activities of this lobby and suppressing speech everywhere. And we can, if we have time, we can go over some of their other campaigns, which are numerous and very ugly in my view. With that, you know, reaction started immediately, and I think that reaction went all the way to the shores of Ann Arbor and maybe got to some people. But what I heard afterwards, and this is complicated because I'm also talking on the phone with Pluto Press, who's a very, really lovely group of people in the north end of London, are quite worried because their future is at stake. If that distribution relationship is knocked off, they are in serious trouble. Okay? They might be able to replace it, but the transition from one distributor to another is a very grave problem for a very small press like Pluto and could be, you know, extremely, you know, injurious to them. We're talking about this, and 3 days later, I get an email from the director of Pluto Press informing me that the director of the University of Michigan Press has caved in, has actually changed his tone, and the book has now been unbanned. But it hasn't really been welcomed back into the into the family of intellectually respectable productions. For one thing, it's still off the University of Michigan website. It was taken off the website on the 22nd of August, hasn't been replaced. It's unbanned. It's not at all clear what's going to happen. What seems to have happened is that the next higher person in the university hierarchy told the director of the University of Michigan Press that he had done something quite unacceptable, that he had no business suppressing this book arbitrarily and unilaterally, and that this was not the way to handle it. And there was even some talk about, let's open up a debate on this subject. And then everything was sealed. Everything's been sealed since then, which is about the 25th of August. What's going to happen now is that the university is finally, apparently, going to be meeting the end of this week with the even higher-ups, the people who are above that dean, like the provost and perhaps even the president, because this is a serious issue for them, since they're now being, put into a big vice where there's a huge amount of pressure. All the weight of the Zionist lobbies is now going to be applied to them, and we'll see how they're going to withstand it. And remember, the University of Michigan is a very large institution. The days are long since gone when universities were independent enclaves of free thought. They're deeply embedded with society, with the economy, with the state, and so on. The trustees, I think, are appointed largely by the governor. A lot of them are political appointees. They are themselves very subject to pressure. So what could be building here is quite a massive, even monumental struggle for the preservation of free speech on an issue that is arguably as important as any before the world at this time, namely the future of Palestine.
I quite agree with you, Joel, and Michael does too. We're really at a turning point here, I think. There's a range of discussion in this country, very narrow, that's allowed. You've got this right-wing party in power now, and you've got kind of a center-right party outside of power. Right. And any kind of idea within those bounds are okay. Your book is clearly way out of bounds.
Yeah.
And whether an institution like the University of Michigan is going to be seen as a sponsor of your book is what's at issue here. And I think even if Michigan does come down on the right side, we've still got the Zionist Thought Police lobby to contend with, because they're not going to like a decision that goes against them. So I think what we've been doing here is informing our radio audience of a struggle that's really just unfolding.
Yes.
What's really sad to me is that, and I don't know what they're going to decide at Michigan, it's incredibly sad that for them to decide to continue to publish the book is actually somewhat heroic in this context.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's an outrage.
Yes,
I mean, this should have been this is nothing.
It's
this
a no-brainer.
Like, right, a no-brainer. It's a clear free speech issue. They're the publisher. Yeah. It's important ideas, as you said, on probably one of the most important subjects of the day.
Yeah.
And because of their lock-in with the really corporate America, the structures of that state, that they actually have to do backflips about whether to publish a book. It's remarkable. Hopefully the controversy will make this book into a bigger seller than it already is.
Well,
that's the only positive part.
There's an upside,
see,
I suppose. But I should point out that I haven't seen the contract between Pluto and the University of Michigan, but I've been told by Pluto that the contract in no way enables the University of Michigan to, so to speak, cherry pick and decide which of their books to distribute or not.
The question though, Joel, is what does distribute mean? They said to you they're going to distribute the book, I guess.
Yeah.
But does it mean they have to put it on their website?
Well, I should think it does. But primarily it means that they enable the book to be moved into bookstores and to be purchased by, university libraries and the like. It's a conduit for the spread of this book.
The problem is, how do you police that? You know how these guys go? They go to the university bookstores in other states. They have a meeting. And the salesman shows the books, and
this is national distribution. We're not talking about a Michigan distribution.
No, I'm talking about national. How do you actually police it to make sure they're doing it?
You can't do it. As a practical matter,
if
they lose interest in distributing your book, what are you going to do? Go to court and sue them and get an injunction and tell them, get on the stick and distribute it better?
Yeah, it's a problem.
It's a real problem.
It's a problem.
The Zionist Thought Police seem to me to be on a roll. They just got Norman Finkelstein denied tenure and then had his class taken away from him at a Catholic university. And before that, here in New York last winter, they had the Rachel Corrie play banned.
Right in New York City, the principal of the Khalil Gibran High School, Debbie Almantasser, a Yemeni woman, was viciously attacked by many people and forced out for no reason at all, really, except that she was a Muslim. If we think anti-Muslim racism is a big problem up to now, it's going to get a lot worse.
Yeah,
and this is part of that.
I agree. Latest flashpoint just may be over the distribution of your book, Overcoming Zionism. Yeah. So, Joel Covell, we greatly admire you. It's hard, just as a human being, to take these kinds of insults. And you should know that you've got a lot of support from this show and from
our
audience. We're going to keep everybody informed here. We're going to fight on your side to keep this book out in front of the public. Right. Thanks, Joel.
Thank you, Joel. I also know how long it took you to write this book, having known you for a long time.
About 3 years on and off.
Right.
But let me say one final point. I mean, in writing this book, I wrote it not to be suppressed, but to go beyond the official prescribed discourse and to say things that you're just not supposed to say, and yet which are eminently reasonable. And so I knew that I was courting trouble of this kind. And the fight has to be taken to the battlefield where it's occurring, which is right now and here at the University of Michigan.
You're really a credit to every lapsed Jew out there.
All right, Charlie.
Bye, guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.